And I want to begin my sermon this evening by acknowledging a couple of things. This is what you might call my summer readings sermon. The New Yorker magazine, if I remember correctly, puts out an annual summer reading issue. And from time to time, I like to do a summer reading sermon. And I want to acknowledge that in writing this sermon, I drew inspiration from three of my favorite writers, Mark Twain, John Steinbeck, and most of all from Robert Louis Stevenson, who's also included in our liturgies tonight. And as I sat down to write this sermon, I was suddenly and painfully aware that all of these three writers are dead, white, straight males who were baptized into the Presbyterian Church and who spent time living and writing in Northern California. Which is to say that in this sermon, I am bringing some of the wisdom from the elders of my tribe. For I, too, am a straight, white, Northern Californian Presbyterian male writer. I'm not dead yet, and I pray my demise will be long in coming, but I'm aware that life is anything if not fragile and temporary. Later in the sermon, I'm going to circle back around to the lack of diversity in my choice of writers that I'm citing this evening, but for now, I'd simply like to acknowledge the homogeneity of my sources and then move on to the second thing I want to acknowledge, which is that the passage that Mary Ellen read before the start of this sermon is one that for years has bothered me. I like the peacenik Christ. I like Jesus in Birkenstocks. I like Jesus to look like a hippie and call himself the Prince of Peace. I like Jesus to tell us that the peacemakers are blessed, and when we are peacemakers, we are children of God. I am bothered by the Jesus who speaks of bringing not peace but a sword, who says the kingdom of God will pit family and neighbor against one another. You see, it turns out that I am, by nature and training, the kind of American whose first inclination is to adore the middle ground. In times of conflict, I try to find a win-win solution for all the parties involved. I am grateful that in its governance, the modern Presbyterian Church is moving away from a strict adversarial use of Robert's Rules of Order and toward a model of governance through building consensus. And though it's been a long time since I could, with a straight face, call myself anything like a moderate, it can be hard for me to let go of the idea that moderation in all things is good and godly. It's a perfect ideal to pursue. And I think that makes me like a lot of Americans. We Americans consider balance to be a great virtue. We want to hear both sides of the story. We assume that for every thesis there is an equally valid antithesis. It is all part of our commitment to a democracy and a society of equality where every opinion has at least some bit of merit. It is an attractive way to think. For all of these reasons, I struggle with this evening's lesson from Luke. But when I'm being honest, I also struggle with this passage because it lays a burden upon us. It calls us to do a very difficult thing, something that I think is especially difficult for Americans, especially for progressive Americans. This passage calls us to set aside our cultural preference for the middle ground, and it calls us to place justice over interpersonal harmony. It calls us to be committed to truth, even at the cost of disruption. This is not to say that working for justice or speaking the truth always will lead to discord. In fact, the end game of working for justice and speaking truth, the end game involves a checkmate in which all things loving and peaceful and compassionate and kind win out over discord, strife, hate, and discontent. Yet still, before we reach that promised land, sometimes we first must speak truth that leads to justice. And sometimes those words of justice seeking truth cause division. In his essay, The Morality of the Profession of Letters, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote, "Those who write have to see that each man's knowledge is as near as they can make it answerable to the facts of life, that he shall not suppose himself an angel or a monster, nor take his word, take this world for a hell, nor be suffered to imagine that all rights are concentrated in his own caste or country, or all veracities in his own parochial creed. Each man should learn what is within him that he may strive to mend. He must be taught what is without him that he may be kind to others. It can never be wrong to tell him the truth, for in his disputable state, weaving as he goes his theory of life, steering himself, cheering or reproving others, all facts are the first importance to his conduct. And even if a fact shall discourage or corrupt him, it is still best that he should know it, for it is in this world as it is, and not in the world made easy by educational suppressions, that he must win his way to shame or glory. In one word, it must always be foul to tell what is false, and it can never be safe to suppress what is true. He should tell the kind of wholesome and beautiful elements of our life. He should tell unsparingly the evil and the sorrow of the present to move us with instances. He should tell of the wise and good people in the past to excite us by example. And of these he should tell soberly and truthfully, not glossing faults, that we may neither grow discouraged with ourselves nor exacting to our neighbors. Now, what I've just read is long, and I know it sounds nice enough. We should always tell good things that are beautiful, good things that are difficult, good things and true things that move us to be better people. It sounds good. But the best example of Stevenson involving himself in this kind of truth-telling that I know about involves Stevenson coming to the defense of the memory and legacy of Father Damien of Molokai. Father Damien was a Belgian priest who lived and died while working at a Hawaiian leper colony in Molokai. After Damien's death, a Presbyterian missionary doctor living in comfort in Honolulu, someone who'd never met the Belgian priest but was an acquaintance of Stevenson's, this Presbyterian missionary doctor wrote a scathing letter about Damien, calling him a coarse, lazy, and dirty man who contracted the leprosy that killed him through having intercourse with patients on the island. In response, Robert Louis Stevenson composed a long essay that may be the most effective and inspiring ad hominem nastygram that I've ever read. Nowhere does Stevenson try to find middle ground or preserve the friendship he happened to have with the Presbyterian missionary who found it necessary to speak ill of Father Damien. The truth was too important, and justice was too important to be nice. Instead, Stevenson put truth and justice first, and that caused a necessary division between the two men who knew each other and who both happened to be Presbyterian. In one of the gentler parts of the letter, Stevenson writes to this Presbyterian minister, "Your church and Damien's were in Hawaii upon a rivalry to do well, to help, to edify, to set divine examples. You having in one huge instance failed and Damien succeeded, I marvel it should not have occurred to you that you were doomed to silence, that when you had been outstripped in that high rivalry, sat inglorious in the midst of your well-being in your pleasant room, and Damien, crowned with glories and horrors, toiled and rotted in that pigsty under the cliffs of Kalawao, you, the elect, would not, were the last man on earth to collect and propagate gossip on the volunteer who would and did." Stevenson said it was the work of writers to tell the truth and to speak of beauty, and he did. He spoke truth to power, and he spoke of the beauty of Damien's service to humanity. He wrote words of justice, but those words didn't inspire the Presbyterians and the Catholics in Hawaii to sit down and sing Kumbaya. He didn't try to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. He just said what was true and spoke of what was just. There comes a time in the living of our lives when we must say what is true, a time when we must do what is just, even if it causes division. I think, for example, of what may be the most important moment in American literature, when in the novel Huckleberry Finn, the protagonist starts worrying about the state of his soul. He's worrying about the state of his soul because he's been traveling down the Mississippi River on a raft with a runaway slave named Jim. Now, Huck Finn was raised in a society that believed it was a mortal sin to harbor a runaway slave. And for a while, Huck was tempted to turn his friend Jim over to the authorities because he was worried he would go to hell. He'd even penned a letter to Jim's slaveholder, providing Jim's whereabouts as a way of safeguarding the eternal well-being of his soul. But then Huck starts to think about all the ways that Jim has cared for him and protected him on their shared journey down the river. Huck Finn, you see, is a child, and Jim has acted as a surrogate father to Huck. And Huck, on some levels, knows this. And as he thinks about his friend Jim, he wads up his letter and he throws it into the river, declaring that he'd rather go to hell than send Jim back into slavery. I don't imagine that that was an easy story to write in the 19th century in the United States, a time when our national house was divided over slavery. I'm sure that lots of folks would have counseled Mark Twain to be quiet, to go back to writing about jumping frogs and about traveling around the world. But Mark Twain knew that he had a responsibility to speak words of justice and truth, even at the cost of stirring up divisions in his community. Something similar can be said for John Steinbeck, whose novels such as The Grapes of Wrath and Of Mice and Men, as well as his travel narratives like Notes from the Sea of Cortez and Travels with Charlie in Search of America. Steinbeck in these books wrote about economic inequality and about how moneyed interests tend to disregard the well-being of the men and women who perform physical and manual work. For the most part, Steinbeck wrote books about agricultural workers, often in the Salinas Valley. His words were true and they pointed to justice. And when I was a pastor in the Salinas Valley some 30 years after Steinbeck died, there were members of my congregation who still remembered John Steinbeck as a local, and they remembered hating him. Some even remembered throwing rocks at the house where Steinbeck's parents still lived, stones they threw at the behest of their own mothers and fathers, who were driven to distraction by the truth and the justice of Steinbeck's words. Steinbeck's calls for economic justice didn't bring peace to the Salinas Valley, at least not right away. But they were good words. They were good words because they spoke truth and they called for justice. And as such, they caused a necessary division. So far in this sermon, I've given you words of Stevenson denouncing religious bigotry, of Mark Twain speaking against slavery, and of Steinbeck addressing issues around economic inequality. All of these authors had detractors in their time. All three were told to tone down the rhetoric. All three were told that their words caused division. But here's the thing. Those words written by Steinbeck and Stevenson and Twain, they didn't actually cause division. In reality, they just named a division and various divisions that were already present in their communities and in their societies. They may have caused division between white Protestants like themselves who didn't want to know or didn't want to be reminded about injustice and untruth. And in the end, the writer's words were words of love that worked to heal a much bigger division, divisions that were long present in the human family. The pain their words caused was the pain of alcohol on a wound. It hurts, but it kills germs. Ultimately, the necessary divisions of the kingdom of God are divisions that break up the power of injustice so that a greater, stronger, truer reality may emerge, a place where it's not just the powerful who get along with one another, but a place where the bonds of love extend beyond the boundaries that are erected by human frailty. And speaking of human frailty, let me circle back now and talk about my decision to quote three literary elders of my tribe of Northern Californian writers who are Presbyterian, white, straight, and male. It was a choice that lacked diversity. But there's also a word of truth contained in this collection of writers, and that word of truth is this. In these troubling and confusing times, straight white Presbyterian males must not allow ourselves to be defined by those who also use those adjectives to define themselves. There are those who call themselves Presbyterians, males, who are bigots. And we do not need to allow those people to define us, because as we know, love trumps hate. We can do better. We must do better. We have artistic and literary inspirations to do better. And in that way, I suppose that my tribe is like every other tribe. We have our heroes and we have our rogues. And we can choose between the two. In all things, may we choose what is right and just and true. In all things, may we speak words that reflect the choice for truth and justice, even at the cost of separation. This is a necessary division, but in the end, it is a division that leads to a greater and a deeper unity. In the end, it leads us to a place of love, and that is good indeed.